over Europe's millions, and who had often exercised it, wandered about in the vicinity of Flensburg until May 21st, when he set out with 11 SS officers to try to pass through the British and American lines to his native Bavaria. Himmler, it must have galled him, had shaved off his mustache, tied a black patch over his left eye, and donned an army private's uniform. The party was stopped the first day at a British control point between Hamburg and Bremerhaven. After questioning, Himmler confessed his identity to a British army captain, who hauled him away to Second Army headquarters at Lüneburg. There he was stripped and searched and made to change into a British army uniform to avert any possibility that he might be concealing poison in his clothes. But the search was not thorough. Himmler kept his vial of potassium cyanide concealed in a cavity of his gums. When a second British intelligence officer arrived from Montgomery's headquarters on May 23rd and instructed a medical officer to examine the prisoner's mouth, Himmler bit on his vial and was dead in 12 minutes, despite frantic efforts to keep him alive by pumping his stomach and administering emetics. The remaining intimate collaborators of Hitler lived a bit longer. I went down to Nuremberg to see them. I'd often watched them in their hour of glory and power at the annual party rallies in this town. In the dock before the International Military Tribunal, they looked different. There had been quite a metamorphosis. Attired in rather shabby clothes, slumped in their seats, fidgeting nervously, they no longer resembled the arrogant leaders of old. They seemed to be a drab assortment of mediocrities. It seemed difficult to grasp that such men, when last you had seen them, had wielded such monstrous power, that such as they could conquer a great nation and most of Europe. There were 21 of them in the dock. Dr. Robert Ley, head of the Arbeitsfront, who was to have been a defendant, had hanged himself in his cell before the trial began. He had made a noose from rags torn from a towel, which he had tied to a toilet pipe. Göring, 80 pounds lighter than when last I had seen him, in a faded Luftwaffe uniform, without insignia, and obviously pleased that he had been given the number one place in the dock. A sort of belated recognition of his place in the Nazi hierarchy now that Hitler was dead. Rudolf Hess, who had been the number three man before his flight to England. His face now emaciated, his deep-set eyes staring vacantly into space, feigning amnesia but leaving no doubt that he was a broken man. Ribbentrop, at last shorn of his arrogance and his pompousness, looking pale, bent, and beaten. Keitel, who had lost his jauntiness. Rosenberg, the muddled party philosopher, whom the events which had brought him to this place appeared to have awakened to reality at last. Julius Streicher, the Jew-baiter of Nuremberg, was there. This sadist and pornographer, whom I had once seen striding through the streets of the old town brandishing a whip, seemed to have wilted. A bald, decrepit-looking old man, he sat perspiring profusely, glaring at the judges and convincing himself, so a guard later told me, that they were all Jews. There was Fritz Zalkel, the boss of slave labor in the Third Reich, his narrow little slit eyes giving him a porcine appearance. He seemed nervous, swaying to and fro. Next to him was Baldur von Schirach, the first Hitler youth leader and later Gauleiter of Vienna, more American by blood than German and looking like a contrite college boy who has been kicked out of school for some folly. There was Walter Funk, the shifty-eyed non-entity who had succeeded Schacht. And there was Dr. Schacht himself, who had spent the last months of the Third Reich as a prisoner of his once-revered Führer in a concentration camp, fearing execution any day, and who now bristled with indignation that the Allies should try him as a war criminal. Franz von Papen, more responsible than any other individual in Germany for Hitler's coming to power, had been rounded up and made a defendant. He seemed much aged, but the look of the old fox who had escaped from so many tight fixes was still imprinted on his wizened face. Neurath, Hitler's first foreign minister, a German of the old school, with few convictions and little integrity, seemed utterly broken. Not Speer, who made the most straightforward impression of all and who during the long trial spoke honestly and with no attempt to shirk his responsibility and his guilt. Zeiss Inquart, the Austrian Quisling, was in the dock, as were Jodl and the two Grand Admirals, Raeder and Dönitz, the latter, the successor to the Führer, looking in his store suit for all the world like a shoe clerk. There was Kaltenbrunner, the bloody successor of Hangman Heydrich, who on the stand would deny all his crimes. And Hans Frank, the Nazi inquisitor in Poland, who would admit some of his, having become in the end contrite and, as he said, having rediscovered God, whose forgiveness he begged, and Frick, as colorless on the brink of death as he had been in life, and finally Hans Fritzsche, who had made a career as a radio commentator because his voice resembled that of Goebbels, who had made him an official in the propaganda ministry. No one in the courtroom, including Fritzsche, seemed to know why he was there. He was too small a fry, unless it were as a ghost for Goebbels, and he was acquitted. So were Schacht and Papen. All three later drew stiff prison sentences from German denazification courts, though, in the end, they served very little time. Seven defendants at Nuremberg drew prison sentences. Hess, Rader, and Funk for life, Speer and Schirach for 20 years, Neurath for 15, Dönitz for 10. The others were sentenced to death. At 1:11 a.m. on October 16, 1946, Ribbentrop mounted the gallows in the execution chamber of the Nuremberg prison, and he was followed at short intervals by Keitel, Kaltenbrunner, Rosenberg, Frank, Frick, Streicher, Seyss-Inquart, Sauckel, and Jodl. But not by Hermann Göring. He cheated the hangman. 2 hours before his turn would have come, he swallowed a vial of poison that had been smuggled into his cell. Like his Führer, Adolf Hitler, and his rival for the succession, Heinrich Himmler, he had succeeded at the last hour in choosing the way in which he would depart this earth, on which he, like the other two, had made such a murderous impact. Afterward. This book had a surprising reception. No one, not my publisher, my editor, my agent, my friends, believed that the public would buy a book so long, so full of footnotes, so expensive, and on such a subject. My lecture agent had told me there was no more interest in Hitler and the Third Reich, and that I would have to talk about something else. My publisher printed only 12,500 copies in advance. The fact that the book started at once to attract considerable readership was therefore a pleasant surprise to us all. I never kept track of the sales myself, either of the hardcover edition brought out by Simon & Schuster, or the mass-market paperback edition brought out by Fawcett. I was surprised to hear 2 or 3 years ago that the Book of the Month Club had sold more copies of The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich than of any other book in its history. But how many copies, I have no idea. The book also did well abroad, in Britain, France, and Italy, though less well in Germany. The reviews of the book, except in Germany, were much more perceptive than I had expected. And though the academic historians, on the whole, were cool to the book and to me, as if I were a usurper with no right to invade their field, to write good history they said you had to teach it, there were notable exceptions. H.R. Trevor Roper, for instance. I felt some trepidation when I first heard that the Sunday New York Times Book Review had given him the book to review. He was a prestigious historian at Oxford whom I much admired. I had found his book, The Last Days of Hitler, very valuable. But British book reviewers at that time had been rather hard on American authors, and besides, as an eminent academic, Trevor Roper might share, I thought, the disdain of his American colleagues for journalists who try to write history. So I concluded that I would probably be clobbered in the publication that was most important for American writers and their books. But Trevor Roper, too, surprised. The headline above his page one review gave a hint as to what he would have to say. Light on our century's darkest night. The awful story of Hitler's Germany is movingly told in masterly study. In ordinary circumstances, Trevor Roper began, it would be impossible only half a generation after its end to write its history. But with the Third Reich, nothing was ordinary, not even its end. In that total annihilation, all the secrets of Hitler's rule were broken open, all the archives captured. Now, as never before, the living witnesses can converge with the historical truth. All they need is a historian. In William L. Shirer, they have found one. This was heady stuff, and at the very beginning of the review. It almost took my breath away. The concluding lines were almost as breathtaking. This is a splendid work of scholarship, objective in method, sound in judgment, inescapable in its conclusions. I was brought down to earth by the front-page review in the rival New York Herald Tribune Book Review. Its author, Gordon A. Craig, then a historian at Princeton, did not agree at all with his Oxford colleague that the Third Reich had found its historian in me. By no means. He thought the book was too long and out of balance. He regretted that I had not read the book of an obscure German historian. The fact that the book was based not on what other historians had written, but on original sources, captured secret German documents, did not impress him, if he noticed it. In Germany, to put it mildly, the book did not fare very well with the reviewers. The Germans simply could not face up to their past. Led by the Chancellor of West Germany, Konrad Adenauer, the book was furiously attacked and the author maligned. "A German hater," Adenauer called me. Since the book dealt objectively with Nazi Germany and the crimes the Germans committed against the human spirit and against their neighbors and against the Jews of Europe, and since I allowed the documented facts to speak for themselves, I was somewhat taken aback by the vehemence of the German reaction, but not entirely surprised. And now, as the 30th anniversary edition of The Rise and Fall goes to press, the world is suddenly confronted with a new reunification of Germany. Soon, united, Germany will be strong again economically, and, if it wishes, militarily, as it was in the time of Wilhelm II and Adolf Hitler. And Europe will be faced again with the German problem. If the past is any guide, the outlook is not very promising for Germany's neighbors, who twice in my lifetime have been invaded by the Teutonic armies. The last time, under Hitler, as the readers of this book are reminded, the German behavior was a horror in its barbarism. People ask now, have the Germans changed? Many in the West appear to believe so. I myself am not so sure, my view no doubt clouded by the personal experience of having lived and worked in Germany in the Nazi time. The truth is that no one really knows the answer to that crucial question, and quite understandably, the nations that were former victims of German conquest do not want to take any chances again. Is there a solution to the German problem? Perhaps. It lies in enmeshing reunited Germany in a European security system out of which it could never break loose to pursue its past policies of aggression. In one fundamental sense, the situation has changed since the fall of the Third Reich. The development of the hydrogen bomb, as I mentioned at the end of my foreword, written in 1959, has rendered an old-fashioned conqueror like Adolf Hitler obsolete. If ever a new adventurer such as Hitler tried to lead the Germans to new conquests, he would be repelled by a nuclear response. That would put a quick end to German aggression. But unfortunately, it would put an end to the world, too. So maybe the H-bomb and the rockets and planes and submarines designed to deliver it, horrible threat though they are to the survival of the planet, will ironically help at least to solve the German problem. No more bloody conquests by the Germans or by anyone else. Perhaps it will help, too, if the erring governments and the wandering people of this world will remember the dark night of Nazi terror and genocide that almost engulfed our world, and that is the subject of this book. Remembrance of the past helps us to understand the present. William L. Shirer, May 1990. This concludes the reading of The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, A History of Nazi Germany, by William L. Shirer. Copyright 1959-1960 by William L. Shirer. Copyright renewed 1987-1988 by William L. Shirer. Afterward, copyright 1990 by William L. Shirer. This book was read by Grover Gardner. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with William L. Shirer and was produced in 2010 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.